is brilliant news. Just before I let you go, can you do a duck impression? Hey, that was pretty good. Genuinely thought that was Spike. I'm very impressed. See, there you go. Riad Khalaf, great to chat to you. Send our love to Spike, will you, as well?
I'll do.
All right, just approaching 6 o'clock. Let's get our news headlines.
The Voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
The headlines then at 6 o'clock on Drive. The Prime Minister has paid tribute to the actress Dame Maggie Smith, who's died aged 89, saying she was a true national treasure. Her family have described her as an extraordinary mother and grandmother. In recent years, she was best known for her roles as Violet Crawley in Downton Abbey and, as we've been discussing here on Drive, Professor McGonagall in Harry Potter. Our entertainment correspondent is Colin Paterson.
If you go all the way back to the end of the 1960s, the role that took her from the stage to the movie screen and won her the Best Actress Oscar, the prime of Miss Jean Brodie, a role that really showed what made her special. This 1930s schoolteacher in Edinburgh, who again managed to do the whole being stern but being funny. And that maybe is the way of summing up Dame Maggie Smith. She managed to do both those things absolutely brilliantly.
The Israeli military says it's carried out what it's called a precise strike on Hezbollah's central command headquarters in the southern suburbs of Beirut. Sources close to the Lebanese armed group say that 6 buildings were flattened. Two boys who are Britain's youngest ever knife murderers have received life sentences for killing a young man in Wolverhampton. They were just 12 when they stabbed 19-year-old Sean Cesarhay in a park last November. They've been told they'll serve at least 8.5 years in prison, which the victim's family says is too lenient. A major report has found stalking victims are being failed too often by police forces in England and Wales. The review calls for changes, including simplifying stalking protection orders. Emma Lingley-Clark is from the Susie Lamplugh Trust, which provides support for victims.
What the report demonstrates is that frontline officers don't understand the way that stalking shows itself. So we need to train police officers to recognise the course of conduct and the context of those behaviours, because that's what actually shows you that this is stalking, the psychological terror it's causing the victim.
A 32-year-old man who became the first person to admit a charge of riot during last month's disorder has been jailed. Kieran Usher, who threw objects at police officers in Sunderland, was given a sentence of 4 years and 4 months. And Just Stop Oil supporters have thrown soup over 2 Van Gogh paintings, hours after 2 activists were given prison sentences for targeting one of the same works of art. 3 protesters threw soup at Sunflowers 1888 and Sunflowers 1889 at the National Gallery in London. Earlier, 23-year-old Phoebe Plummer and Anna Holland, who's 22, were jailed for their protest 2 years ago. So those are the headlines in the news now. Let's get the sport. Here's Mike McCarthy.
28 runs from the bat of Liam Livingstone in the final over have helped England set Australia 313 for victory in the 4th one-day international at Lord's. The rain-affected match has been reduced to 39 overs aside. England need to win to take the 5-match series to a decider. There's commentary of that Australian chase on 5 Sports Extra, which gets underway very shortly. The All England Club say they're looking to complete 39 new tennis courts at Wimbledon between 2030 and 2033. The plans, which also include a new 8,000-seater stadium, have been given the go-ahead by the Greater London Authority despite strong local opposition. Campaigners could still seek a judicial review. And cycling's governing body, the UCI, says it can't give more information about the death of teenage rider Muriel Fuhrer, with the incident now under investigation by public authorities. The 18-year-old died after suffering a serious head injury at the Road and Paracycling World Championships in Switzerland.
In the latest travel news, on the roads in County Durham, the A1M northbound one lane is closed between junction 60 at Bradbury and 61. It's emergency repairs there, but you have got heavy traffic. In Essex, the A12 northbound, that's partially blocked after junction 22. More emergency repairs causing delays. Congestion is back to junction 18 there. The M25 clockwise, 2 lanes are closed between junction 22 at St Albans and 23. It's a broken down lorry. Traffic is queuing on the approach to that. And there is is still some disruption from the weather and the flooding. Most major routes on the roads now cleared, but some local roads may still be affected. Also, if you're going to catch a train this evening, worth double checking because there has been disruption across the network. Ellie Brennan, 5 Live Travel.
Ellie, thanks very much indeed. It's Drive with Holly and Tony. We're in the last hour. It's nearly the week.
I know. I was just thinking that. I didn't want to say that out loud because I appreciate not everyone has a weekend as such, but you do feel it this time
including
on a Friday.
You.
Including me, yes. But I still get a Friday feeling.
No, that's weird. Yeah, no, I do because I'm not doing anything this weekend. You just remind everyone what they can see you on the telly this weekend on BBC One, is that right?
Yeah, on BBC One Sunday Morning Live.
What
bring
time?
A cup of coffee at 10:30.
Oh, right. Perfect timing,
just
really,
a
for
nice
a Sunday
time,
morning.
Isn't it? Just, yeah, sitting there so.
Is Alan Titchmarsh on it?
He's. No, I think he might be our rival, actually.
Oh, no.
Let's not mention him.
Oh,
don't watch Alan.
Sorry about that.
Come and join us. Bring a coffee and a croissant.
10:30, BBC One Sunday Morning.
That's right.
Sunday Morning Live.
This is the most plugged-in I've ever had, show. Really appreciate that.
What I think about that is that people have heard you all week. They want to, if they haven't...
They might be fed up with me by this point, to be fair.
Not familiar with your TV work. Yeah, they might.
I've heard enough from her.
Where's Alan Titchmarsh? Right, still loads to come in this hour of the programme. Pauline Black's going to join us. Quite excited about that. I played her music when I was younger, followed her career, and particularly two-tone music as well. They're making a film about it, so Pauline's going to tell us her story.
Yeah, looking forward to that. As Mike was telling us in the sport there about Wimbledon, the All England Club has got planning permission to build 39 spanking new tennis courts in Wimbledon Park. We'll be speaking to somebody who's not one bit happy, though. That's just before 7 o'clock.
And just briefly, we had Hamza Yassin on the programme earlier on, Strictly winner, wildlife photographer, author, and it turns out wildlife impersonator.
Is it Hamza?
Well, it is. And so many of you have been reliving the art of animal impersonation.
Which I didn't know was an art.
No,
and there are so many. And what's brilliant, just to give you an idea, on our kind of screen here, we can't hear or see what's coming in, but we just know media is coming in. Yeah. A lot of media, which is your animal noises, so I'm very excited.
We will get to those before the end of the programme as well. It's 6 minutes past six.
This weekend on BBC Radio 5 Live. On Sunday, Manchester United take on Spurs on 5 Live Premier League Sunday.
And the ball does find its way to the back of the net.
And tomorrow, there's updates from around the grounds, as well as live commentary of Arsenal versus Leicester at 3 and Wolves versus Liverpool at 5:30.
Kicks it up, left foot, scored!
5 Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
You are listening to Tony and Holly here with you for the next 50 minutes now. Of course, we're going to be reacting to that sad news that Maggie Smith has died at the age of 89. We'll get more reaction to that, of course, within the next hour. But first, let's get the latest from the Middle East. And there have been huge explosions in Beirut today, which Israel said were the result of what they've described as a precise strike on Hezbollah's headquarters in the Lebanese capital. There had been reports that Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, had been the ultimate target of the raids, but he is reported in some Middle Eastern media as being in a safe place.
Well, this came less than an hour after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the United Nations General Assembly in New York that his country was fighting for its life and that the offensive against Hezbollah would not end until Israel's objectives had been met.
I decided to come here to speak for my people, to speak for my country, to speak for the truth. And here's the truth. Israel seeks peace. Israel yearns for peace. Israel has made peace and will make peace again. Yet we face savage enemies who seek our annihilation. And we must defend ourselves against these savage murderers.
Well, earlier on Drive, I spoke to the Palestinian journalist Dawood Kutab and got his reaction to that speech from Mr. Netanyahu.
What is the problem is he has a country that is trying to have peace with its neighbors without trying to find a peace solution. He refuses a two-state solution. He doesn't negotiate with the Palestinians. He doesn't want to talk to the Lebanese. He doesn't even thank the Americans who are, you know, sending him weapons. This man is a war criminal.
Our correspondent at the UN in New York, Nada Tofik, has more details on what's been happening today at the UN General Assembly. Nada, good evening. It was slightly awkward, I think it's fair to say. There were some cheers at times during that speech. There were definitely some boos, and some people walked out before it even started.
That's right. I mean, the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has been facing protests outside of the United Nations, and inside, dozens of diplomats walked out in protest of the war in Gaza and the dramatic escalation of strikes in Lebanon. The cheers you heard there were from supporters in the gallery that had gone for that express purpose to try to show some support for the Prime Minister. And then he also said some family members of the hostages were also there, though we should note that there are some families of the hostages who are very angry with the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But what everyone was watching for was to see what he might say about a potential ceasefire, because, of course, diplomatic efforts are urgently trying to find a solution, a 21-day ceasefire in Lebanon, as the U.S., France, and other countries had agreed to. But the Prime Minister didn't mention a ceasefire at all in his speech, and instead, he said that Israel was winning and would continue until they reached total victory. He said that the conflicts, who was to blame, was Israel's arch foe, Iran. And he said there was nowhere in Iran or the Middle East that the long arm of Israel could not reach. So for diplomats here, a very troubling sign that there won't be de-escalation anytime soon, despite the U.S. outreach.
And of course, the backdrop of Mr. Netanyahu's speech, Israel were carrying out more strikes in Lebanon this afternoon. As you say, no mention, and purposefully, I would imagine, no mention of a ceasefire. What do you think the speech was telling us in terms of what direction Mr. Netanyahu wants to take this?
Yeah, well, look, in his speech, he made clear that Israel, if anything, feels emboldened. They feel they are winning. He said, without citing evidence, that they feel that they have captured or killed more than half of Hamas's estimated 40,000 fighters and destroyed 90% of Hamas rockets. So he said that they are going to continue but to mop up in Gaza. What it really shows, I think, is this idea that Israel is shifting as well to, obviously, the northern border. And what we're hearing is perhaps even preparing for a ground offensive into Lebanon. So no sign at all that Israel feels it needs to wind down, as the international community would like to see. And, you know, we are also hearing that the Prime Minister is planning to cut his trip short here in the United States and fly back tonight to Tel Aviv.
As you say, Mr. Netanyahu and Israel, he seemed to be emboldened, as you suggested. We were chatting to a Palestinian journalist earlier who suggested that, well, he certainly felt that Western allies were scared to do anything against Mr. Netanyahu, were scared to enforce a ceasefire or anything further. What sense do you get from Western allies?
Well, I mean, what we have seen over the last year is the United States Biden administration completely unwilling to exercise more leverage, not only in conditioning arms, but also going as far as to say that they didn't feel Israel had broken the U.S. longstanding rules, that if they prevent aid from going to civilians or break those kinds of laws, that the country does have to stop those shipments. Many in the international community have said that Israel is blocking aid, but we see the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying that they haven't made that assessment, constantly defending Israel here in the halls of the United Nations and in other international forums. When you hear from the Lebanese foreign minister, for example, here, he says that his country's very existence is at threat and the United States is the only country who can help, but they haven't done enough and he's not very hopeful. President Biden, of course, has domestic concerns. There is an election coming up. And one senior Western diplomat I spoke to here says that's very much on people's minds, the election and the fact that perhaps there won't be any movement until after November 5th, when a winner is declared. And perhaps in the interim period, the Biden administration might take some tougher stance against its ally.
At the General Assembly today, do you get a sense that not only do people present there, do they feel like Mr. Netanyahu cares what they think, what their attitude is, and do they feel they've got any control in this situation?
Well, look, I mean, if you just listen back to Benjamin Netanyahu's speech, it is a very belligerent tone towards the United Nations. It has to be said. It always has been. He slammed it as an anti-Semitic swamp. And he has had a very tough relationship because the United Nations has accused Israel of war crimes, has accused them of targeting their humanitarian workers in Gaza, of targeting journalists, of disproportionately carrying out this war without regard for civilian lives. So it has been, for the last few months, a very tough relationship where the Prime Minister hasn't even spoken to the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. But Israel has a very powerful ally in the United States. It knows that, and so it continues to carry out its war.
Our correspondent at the UN in New York, Nada Tofik, thank you for those details on what went down today at the UN General Assembly. Benjamin Netanyahu making that speech there this afternoon. It is 6:15.
Not long to go on Drive here this evening. Lots more to bring you. Our must-watchers, Scott Bryan, is going to join us to discuss the legacy of Dame Maggie Smith and her extraordinary career. It'll be really interesting to get Scott's take on that. And talking of legendary women, we're going to be joined by the selectors Pauline Black as well to talk about the new film about her life, Two Tone.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, we'll be chatting to a woman in just a few moments who is not very happy at today's decision that the All England Tennis Club will be allowed to extend its premises at Wimbledon into the nearby Parkland. And then Darren Fletcher will be here with his weekly Premier League kickoff from 7 o'clock. Busy night ahead. We've got some rugby league live tonight from 9 o'clock as Salford Red Devils take on the Lee Leopards in the elimination playoffs. All that's still to come.
Yeah, thank you very much for all your texts to the show as well. Earlier on, we were talking to the Strictly winner, author, wildlife photographer Hamza Yassin, who's got a kid's book out on wildlife. Really good book as well. And he was doing owl impersonations for it. He did get me talking about Percy Edwards and just Helen in West Bay. Says, hi, Tony and Holly, because Holly, as you know, show over 3 hours. People join us all the time. Does anyone remember Percy Edwards? He was a great animal impersonator.
That came up today, didn't it?
I couldn't remember him, but then I was reminded of him by the listeners, which is great. This text here from Jane says, I learned to crow like a cockerel as a child. We had lots of bantams wandering around the garden and more cockerels than hens. It was a racket, not just in the morning. So I thought if I learned to crow back, they might shut up. It just made it worse.
Nope, doesn't work.
I think we've got, hang on, we've got, she's sent it in. Hang on.
Is this her cockerel or
yes,
making the
this
cockerel
is
noise?
Jane's cockerel.
Okay, that's definitely Jane.
Blimey, I think she'll be at the GP's now after making that noise.
Just image them of the cockerel shouting back at her. All right then.
Randomly, this is a farmyard trio from Dougal. Ooh, another one.
Dougal. That one's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
All very forceful though, Dougal. Yeah. I like a more peaceful farm than that.
Get a lozenge.
You could now know how time passed when I was younger.
Yes, that's what you do.
Now you still
haven't told me which animal you're.
Can't do it. No, I'm just a voyeur.
You just enjoy
whatever a listening version of being
you
a voyeur
just
is.
Enjoy listening to other people make it. You are in your element today.
It is. Keep sending those in 0808 5996. We've loads to get through. 6:17.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network.
5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, heavy rain and flash floods have caused disruption in central England. Three drivers were rescued on the M5 near Bristol, while a rail tunnel has been flooded between Bicester and Banbury. Trains are running at reduced speed on the East Coast mainline due to flooding between Peterborough and King's Cross. Our reporter Jo Inwood is in the village of Kempston in Bedfordshire.
There's about 30 properties here that, as you can see, are either at risk of flooding or some of them further down have actually got water going in. Now, it's only 20 centimetres or so, according to the rescue guys down there, but that's enough to do real damage to both to flooring, to properties, and to really ruin somebody's house. And this is something that they are very concerned about round here, because the Great River Ouse, which is just 100 yards or so that way, there are fears it could burst its banks. Now, my way here, I drove through Bedford, and you can see it is very high. It's flowing quickly. quickly. The good news is that there aren't any more severe weather warnings in place. No more rain is going to be falling, not in great quantities around here or much of the rest of the UK. But we still have the water that's fallen on higher ground. That's going to run down and that could cause more problems.
So many different stories emerging from the flooding. Steve Hayes, counterintuitively, is trapped on a canal boat south of Banbury because of the flooding. Hello, Steve.
Good evening.
Hi, well, what's happened around you?
Well, we've just come back up from Oxford, up the Oxford Canal towards the Midlands, and we've been trapped because the rainfall up in the sort of the Banbury area on the River Cherwell has created so much water that, strange enough, we can't actually move anywhere because there's so much water coming through the locks, it's impossible to move.
Right. So the obvious question is how on earth can you flood a canal so the locks won't open? I got the impression the phone line wasn't great.
That's what happens on a canal boat, I understand.
There's about... The River Cherwell's in certain... Hello?
Yeah, hello. Hello, Steve. Yeah, we're losing you. Just say hello again, Steve. Let's see if we got you back.
Try go starboard.
Hello there.
Got you back. I was just saying, so the key problem for you is the locks won't open.
Correct, yes. We can travel along the various flat bits of canal, but obviously that lasts half a mile or a mile, and then we have to go up the locks and they don't work.
Right. So I mean, I presume your vessel is watertight, obviously, so you're just going to have to sit it out, are you?
Yeah, we've been here for 5 days now, and probably another 5 to 7 days before we can move on.
Right. And presumably, how about getting off to buy groceries and things like that? You can access it, or have you got stuff on board, Steve?
We've got stuff on board, so it's not too bad. And luckily, we've got enough diesel, and I've got a reasonable quantity of water so I can drink and do the usual domestic stuff. But the food situation, there is a shop, but it's about a mile and a half walk from where I am. So if the rain stops, I'll be having a long walk.
Yeah. Well, make a list. Don't forget anything, Steve.
No.
That's just a tip from me. How are you passing the time? Listening to the radio, he said, hopefully?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
We're listening to the radio, watching the telly, doing the usual stuff.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, you'll get through it. Good to talk to you, Steve.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Steve Hayes there, trapped on a flooded canal, of all things, south of Banbury. I gave it a go. I think the line was wobbly.
We got the gist.
21 minutes past six now.
Now, two 13-year-olds have been sentenced today to a minimum of 8 years and 6 months in custody for the murder of Sisahe, which happened when they were just 12 years old. They are the youngest defendants to be convicted of murder since the killers of James Bulger in 1993. Now, earlier in the show, we were speaking to a psychologist, Dr. Naomi Murphy, about the mental state of children who commit acts like this.
I've spent nearly 3 decades working with people who've killed. They've always had histories of abuse and neglect during childhood, and when you've experienced violence and abuse, it's really, you don't learn how to manage your feelings, and some people end up carrying around quite a lot of rage. So if you're powerless to direct it at the people who've hurt you, this can end up being displaced onto someone who just happens to be innocently irritating you in another way.
Well, let's get more reaction to this from Mark Fairhurst, who is the chair of the Prison Officers Association and joins me now. Evening, Mark.
Good evening.
I think this is a case that obviously has shocked so many people, and you are someone who's worked in the prison service since 1992, particularly with young offender institutions. For a child, and we are talking about two children ultimately there, who are entering the prison system now at this level, what is the process? How do you deal with that?
Yes, so at the moment, with them being such a young age of 13, it's unlikely that we'd receive them into a prison environment for another couple of years. It's very rare for us to deal with someone under the age of 15 unless they've got very complex needs. So I would imagine, especially after me listening to the judge's sentence and remarks, because they're doing so well, I would imagine they'll be in social services care for a wee while yet before we house them. But when they do come into a prison environment, They will have all the support services that they're now experiencing. They will be assessed by mental health teams. They will have access to psychiatrists and psychologists. They will have dedicated staff to look after them. But of course, where they are now in a stable environment with good staffing levels is completely different to what they will experience as a child in prison and ultimately an adult in prison, because they will be in prison as adults.
How important is that in a case like this? We heard the backgrounds of the two killers, and particularly when one of those involved came from a very difficult background. And therefore, the treatment and the way you approach someone who's been convicted with something like this has to be very different, I expect.
So we have one specialist unit within the youth custody estate. That's at Wetherby. That's called the Keppel unit. It has very good staffing levels. It has very good interventions and support for people with complex needs. But I would imagine by the time they reach us, if they continue on the progressive path that a judge has highlighted today, then they may not need a specialist unit. And that's really when the problems occur, because most of the violence in the prison estate occurs in the youth custody estate, particularly with prisoners under the age of 18. And it's very difficult not to divulge what you're in for and who you are. I would imagine by the time they go from reception to a wing, everybody will know who they are and what type of high-level offence they've committed. And that's when the issues inside the prison really start.
When you talk about issues inside the prison, what do you mean exactly?
So they will be targeted. There is always somebody who wants to make a name for themselves, because this is such a high-profile case. So our job is to protect them and continue that progression, which is very difficult when you've come from an environment in social services or a secure training centre where the staffing levels are, well, at least three staff to every one child in care. You go into a prison, you're thrown onto a wing where there could be 60 other prisoners with very minimal staffing levels. Mm. So we've got a big gang culture inside youth prisons at the moment. It's trying to protect people and continue that progression so they can lead law-abiding lives when they eventually come up in front of the parole board and are released on licence.
And of course, they will be released on licence, you know, after less than 8 years, given what they've served so far. And that's not the end of it. That does continue.
No. No, it's not. And let's not forget, they may not be released after 8 years and 6 months. It totally depends on their attitudes and behaviours whilst they're in custody. So when they're up for parole, they will be in an adult establishment. If they regress, if they continue their violent tendencies, if they don't conform, then that will all be highlighted to the parole board and they will not be released. But if they are released, they are on a license for the rest of their life. So the slightest little thing they do wrong, they'll end up back inside.
In terms of the duration then, this 8 years and 6 months, obviously the family sees the hay, they are distraught by this. And we have people who've commented this afternoon, 8 years, 6 months as a texter, that's nothing. Why do you think that that particular duration, which isn't for murder, isn't long, arguably?
Well, this is the problem, isn't it? All too often, the victim's opinion and thoughts are ignored. And you've got to feel for the victims of crime, especially when it's such an abhorrent crime. We are bound by law, and judges are bound by sentencing guidelines based on somebody's age. And because they were of such a young age, and because of their family circumstances, and in one particular case, the upbringing that particular person had, experienced, the trauma they'd experienced, the judge reduced that sentence, which the judge could have gave them 13 years as a starting point, but reduced it because of the circumstances and the reports from the specialists who had interviewed them and worked with them. So unfortunately, as harsh as it is to the families and to the victims of crime, the judges have no choice. They've got to abide by sentencing guidelines.
It must be very difficult to make decisions in a case like this, because it is rare, you know, that people straight away make the comparisons to James Bulger's murder in the early 90s. And I suppose lessons have been learned since then, but there's really ultimately no right way to do this, is there?
Well, I think there is an alternative. There is an alternative way, and that is to reform sentencing guidelines in conjunction with victims of crime who've been appalled by the experiences of the justice system. So how do we make justice served and justice appear to be served for those victims and the victims' families? There's only one way, and that's to liaise with them and reform sentencing guidelines. In this case, the families do not think that justice has been served, and they're appalled by that sentence. But our guidelines are there. They're set in stone. There is no alternative. The judge could not do anything else at all because of their age. So I think long-term, a strategy would be, let's liaise with victims of crime, let's see what they want, and let's reform sentencing. So everybody thinks that justice has been served.
Realistically, going forward for these two boys, what would progress look like for them?
Well, progress in our eyes would be they enter the prison system, they conform, they improve their lives, they get educated, they maybe pick up some work skills, they certainly address their offending behaviour, and they progress through the adult estate and eventually get parole and prove themselves in society. No doubt they'll have new identities at the taxpayers' expense and hopefully lead law-abiding lives and commit no further crime. But all too often we hear of further headlines, don't we? Particularly in the Bulger case being a prime example. You know, as far as the public are concerned, if you don't conform and you're on a life licence, why should you ever be released? And that's a difficulty. They will be offered every opportunity to address their problems, their issues and their offending behaviour. They will have an abundance of experts thrown at them. And it's up to them whether they want to accept that and reform and rebuild their lives or not.
In the assessment in terms of their behaviour and their background and the sentencing, of course, a lot of that was put down to the fact that they had a very, very difficult upbringing. Obviously, like I said, it's so rare to have a case like this, but generally with young offender institutions, how common is it that their background, in this sense, that they have gone through some sort of trauma in their lives?
It's very common. I think it's no secret that the majority of people in prison are from deprived areas. They've experienced trauma growing up, maybe been in abusive relationships or had parents which they witnessed violence or were violent too. So it comes as no surprise that people like that continue to be incarcerated. But the key is to invest in our communities and to prevent crime before it occurs by investing and reduce child poverty, reduce violence at home, and get the youth offending teams back on the streets. Of course, that was all curbed, wasn't it, under austerity measures, and now we're reaping the rewards of that, and society's becoming more violent, less respectful for authority, there's more deprivation, there's more child poverty, there's more violence. We need to reverse that trend, but that's not going to happen overnight. This is a long, drawn-out process, which needs a lot of investment.
Yes, but the reason I ask that too is because it's a very fine line, particularly for the victims. When we talk about children in particular, which is what we're referring to here, and how we treat and deal with this in terms of rehabilitation, but also getting justice for the victims. You know, we heard from the Cissahay family today who are not happy, and it's so difficult then to just sort of walk that line in terms of how you find justice for them.
It is very difficult. And again, the victims all too often continue to be victims for the rest of their lives because they're thinking in 8 short years, those people aged 21 will be enjoying life, free people, and I've lost a loved one forever. So we need to reform sentencing so people think justice has been served. And we need to invest in our communities and get coppers back on the beat, get youth offending teams back in our communities, get those youth clubs back open. Let's educate people instead of expelling them from school and really work to eradicate, you know, the depravity that we see in our society. And let's work with these young people before they progress to adult offenders and reduce crime and make our communities safer. Less victims, less violence, less crime on the streets, that's the key to success. But we've got a hell of a job ahead of us, especially if you're in government and you're telling us, you know, the budget in October is going to be painful for all. We've got to find the money from somewhere. If we can find money to bomb countries thousands of miles away, we've got to find money to look after our own and improve life for everyone.
Mark Fairhurst, Chair of the Prison Officers Association, thanks for your time on that. At 6:32, let's get your BBC News headlines.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The King and Queen have joined the tributes to Dame Maggie Smith, who's died at the age of 89. They've released a statement calling her a national treasure and praising her warmth and wit as an actress during her 70-year career. She won 2 Oscars. Multiple explosions have been heard in Beirut after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promised to keep fighting Hezbollah in Lebanon. He addressed the UN General Assembly in New York and resisted international calls for a ceasefire. The family of a 19-year-old man who was stabbed to death in Wolverhampton say the sentences given to his two 13-year-old killers are too lenient. The pair, who were 12 when they murdered Sean Cesar-Hay, have been sentenced to life with a minimum of 8.5 years. And Just Stop Oil supporters have thrown soup over two Vincent van Gogh paintings just hours after two activists were given prison sentences for doing similar things. Phoebe Plummer and Anna Holland were jailed for throwing soup at the painting Sunflowers in 2022. Right, those are the news headlines. Mike McCarthy's got the sport.
Australia chasing 313 for victory in the fourth one-day international against England. Ellie Aldroyd has the latest from Lords.
And they're in the sixth of 39 overs, 33 without loss, with Marsh on 14 and Head on 11. Now, Travis Head getting off the mark with a six a little bit earlier on, and Mitch Marsh giving a chance to be caught, but then the sky catch, Jamie Smith and Will Jacks couldn't decide which of them should go for it, and in the end neither of them did. But earlier on, absolutely brilliant half century from Liam Livingston, 62 off just 27 deliveries, including seven sixes, and hitting 28 runs off the final over from Mitch Stark, the most ever scored in an over of international cricket at Lord's. So 313 the target, Australia 34 without loss in the sixth.
Ellie, thank you. Commentary continues on Five Sports Extra. A controversial and significant expansion plan for the All England club to build 39 tennis courts on protected open land opposite has been given full planning permission. Deputy Mayor of London Jules Pipe made the decision after one of the two councils involved had rejected the plans last year. As part of the new development, there will be a new 8,000-seater stadium on Wimbledon Park, and Wimbledon qualifying will take place on site in future years, something which already happens at the other Grand Slams. Putney MP Fleur Anderson was among those campaigning against the plans.
I'm extremely disappointed. It's been several years of campaigning by thousands and thousands of local people from a very wide area against this very damaging development on our lovely park. And I'm very disappointed that it will now be going ahead.
The final stretch of the Super League season begins, and the race to the grand final starts tonight with the elimination playoffs. First up, Salford Red Devils versus Lee Leopards. Matt Newsome will be watching at the Salford Community Stadium.
Yeah, this game pitches Salford side, who continue to punch above their weight, looking for a place in the semi-finals of the playoffs and repeating potentially the feat that they achieved in 2019 when they made it all the way to Old Trafford just across the River Irwell. In their way tonight are a Lee Leopard side who've won 10 of their last 12. Only Wigan have managed to pick up points from them, and Hull KR, of course, as well. Those are from the top two, so this one promises plenty. Whoever wins will go on to play, most likely Wigan, in those semi-finals.
Matt, thank you. Commentary of that on the BBC Sport website and on Five Live for the second half from 9 o'clock. Meanwhile, the 36-year-old Wigan Warriors prop Mike Cooper's retired on medical advice after suffering a concussion in July. And after a winning start in the Women's Super League, champions Chelsea are at Selhurst Park to face newly promoted Crystal Palace tonight. Flo Pollock's there for us.
It doesn't get much harder than this for newly promoted Crystal Palace tonight, as you said, up against the reigning champions Chelsea. Palace will take heart, though, from the fact that when they faced the champions last season in the FA Cup, it took a Maya Ramirez wonder goal to break them down. And it's a very different Palace team tonight. They've brought in a lot of new players over the summer to try and be competitive in the top tier. New faces for Chelsea, too. The most prominent is, of course, new manager Sonia Bonpastor, taking over from Emma Hayes. She got her first Chelsea win last Friday, looking to make it 2 from 2 tonight.
Flo, thank you. We'll have updates through the evening. That is the latest from BBC Sport, and you can listen on your smart speaker by saying, play BBC Sports News.
In the latest travel news, on the roads in North Yorkshire, the A64 eastbound, there's been an accident at the Fulford interchange, which means really, really slow traffic. It has just been moved from the road, so it's starting to move again. But it's in the roadworks area, so that isn't helping the delays there. In Essex, the A12 northbound, that is partially blocked after junction 22 for emergency repairs. It's making it very slow, congestion back to 18 currently. The M25 clockwise, two lanes are closed. This is between junction junction 22 at St Albans and 23. There's a broken down lorry there which is being recovered, but for now you've got queuing traffic. And just worth double checking, if you are planning to go on a train this evening, there has been disruption across the network because of flooding. Also on the road, some local routes still being affected by that, so just take care this weekend. Ellie Brennan, Five Live Travel.
Cheers, Ellie. Pauline Black's going to join us shortly. More tributes to Maggie Smith. But thank you very much for your messages today on the art of animal impersonation after Hamza Yassin, the Strictly winner, wildlife photographer, author, gave us his owl.
It's a good owl.
Whatever the owl is in Harry Potter, I don't know.
Hedgewick?
Don't know.
Don't know where that came from.
But listen, thank you very much for... So I don't know how often we're going to be able to revisit this. So apparently Chris's lion is quite impressive. Shall we play Chris's lion?
Go for it. Oh, Chris, that is good. That is guttural. Yeah.
Simon's got a dolphin. Ah, yeah, now we get that.
Okay, yeah.
Phil's got a pheasant. What do pheasants do? Do pheasants do anything? Hang on.
We're about to find out.
Oh. What? A lot of these do sound rather painful.
Choked on a peanut, yeah. Someone said, I don't know if they said anything, and someone else earlier on said that their wife does a great impression of a zebra.
Oh.
I'm not quite sure what a zebra is.
Yeah, no, I don't have a zebra here. I've got a hippo. That's got it controversial because it's been in the news this week.
Careful now. I'm not sure he's met a hippo, do you?
I think he sent that into another radio show. Right, I think we've got through the ones we've had so far. Anyway, the ones that are on my box.
Can you do better? Oh.
No. 85058 is the number on WhatsApp. It's 0085 909 693.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
A very good evening. It's Tony and Holly here with you for the next 20 minutes. And I'm sure you've heard by now the sad news that the beloved actress Dame Maggie Smith has died at the age of 81. We've had so many tributes today from right across the celebrity forum and from you listeners as well. We've even heard from the King. Now, he didn't text into the show. He has released a statement. The King has said, on the death of Dame Maggie Smith, my wife and I were deeply saddened to learn of her death. As the curtain comes down on a national treasure, we join all those around the world in remembering with the fondest admiration and affection her many great performances and her warmth and wit that shone through both on and off the stage. And there are so many ways that we remember her throughout that 70-year career. She won two Oscars early on for the prime of Miss Jean Brodie in 1970 and California Suite in 1979. And then she went on to a whole new generation of fans as Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films, delivering some withering one-liners in ITV's Downton Abbey as Violet Crawley, the Dowager Countess of Grantham, and of course starring alongside Whoopi Goldberg in Sister Act. Oh, there are so many, but here are just some of her best bits.
Pier Totum Locomotor. Hogwarts is threatened. Man the boundaries, protect us, do your duty to our school.
I've always wanted to use that spell.
People wish to kill you. Anyone who's met you, I imagine. A disguise is necessary to protect us all. And while you are here, you will conduct yourself as a nun. Only I will know who and what you truly are. You will draw no attention to yourself whatsoever.
But look at me. I'm a nun. I'm a penguin.
As from now and until you leave, you are Sister Mary Clarence.
I don't want a special stick. I want an ordinary stick, only longer. Shut the door.
If I should want to get in touch with you, whom should I call?
Well, you can try Mr. Bennett at 23, only don't take any notice of what he says. He's a communist, possibly.
You're a woman with a brain and reasonable ability. Stop whining and find something to do.
Oh, she's so good. She had some iconic lines. And look, don't come at me if there are your favourites are missing from there, because look, let's face it, there are so many. Let's speak now to Scott Bryan from Five Lives Must Watch podcast. Good evening, Scott.
Evening.
Do you know the thing about Dame Maggie Smith? If you saw that she was in the cast of something, you knew it was going to be good.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's just the fact that the thing that's taken me aback today has been normally when somebody passes away, I think about the roles that they've been in, and you normally manage to kind of think of about one or two. I think with Maggie, it's more than 10. And what is so interesting is it's multi-generational. There's something for the kids that they've seen that they absolutely love, have loved Maggie being in. And there's something with their grandparents. I mean, it's incredibly rare to have an actor that manages to cross different decades and so consistently throughout her career. Her first BAFTA film nomination was for Best Promising Newcomer. And that was back in 1958. And the last nomination was in 2015. So that's more than 60 years, which is just phenomenal. And that's even before you get to, of course, the Oscar wins that she won. She got two Academy Awards, 5 BAFTAs, 4 Emmys, 3 Golden Globes. And also, this is the other thing, it's the range that she was able to cover.
Yeah.
Because she was able to do some incredibly serious roles. She performed Shakespeare. She said that her first love was always on the stage performing. I think she said that it was ephemeral. Like, when you're performing on the stage, you're just there for a moment, and then that moment disappears. But she also was able to do some incredibly comedic roles too. And she's just been, I think, highly regarded and will be missed as much for her wit as for her sort of more serious acting roles.
Yeah, she was one of those people that you hear time and time again, these stories of the director or the writer or whatever of any production. They want her, you know, they write it and they have her in mind while they're writing it, because she was the character.
She was the character. I mean, there are so many, I think that there will always be two sort of roles in her most recent years that will be sort of highly lauded, just because of the amount of people who watched them and just how well she reflected in that role. Of course, in Downton Abbey, which at its height had more than 10 million people, there was 10 million viewers. There were some clips being shared on social media today of some of her favourite lines in that show. I think my favourite personally was when she asks, "What is a weekend?" which is an utter joy. And then, of course, in Harry Potter, hardly needs an introduction, one of the most successful British film franchises of all time. But I think it's the fact that in acting, normally it's incredibly hard to have consistency, because most of the time in acting, you're out of work because you are applying for roles or just simply waiting for the phone to ring. But I think Maggie Smith and I think Dame Judi Dench comes from this generation too, of just actors who were so good at their craft, were so well known and so critically acclaimed that they were able to cross from different from stage to screen to TV with utter ease, and they made it look so effortless, even though of course we know it is incredibly difficult to be performing consistently at the highest level, and she did that.
There's that great documentary, we were chatting about it earlier, Tea with the Dames, you know. Oh. When you mentioned Judi Dench and Joan Plowright and Eileen Atkins, and they are just, as you say, that generation, that era, the stories that they had to tell.
If you're at a loose end tonight and you're thinking, okay, what can I watch? You have to pay for it. It's not free, because I only watched it, funnily enough, only a few weeks ago. I think you can find it on most kind of online streaming sites at a cost of about £2. But it's called Nothing Like a Dame in the UK, and it's all of those dames you just mentioned, essentially going for tea and talking about their career. And it is an utter hoot, because not only do you hear the big things, you know, about the big roles, the directors, the changing responsibilities, the misogyny they experienced early on in their careers, the big breaks they all managed to break to got them into their huge nationwide acclaim. It's also just such a joy to hear them tease each other. They tease each other relentlessly. And it's this glorious moment, a clip that's been shared again this afternoon of Maggie Smith teasing Dame Judi Dench for stealing all of the great Hollywood parts that are given for Brits. And trust me, it's just 1.5 minutes of utter joy. I've really enjoyed seeing that again today.
She's brilliant. Honestly, Scott, we could sit here all night chatting about this because there's just so many more films and series to chat about. Scott Bryan from Five Lives Must Watch podcast. Thank you as always. I just want to take this quote from her BAFTA special award speech in 1993, which is brilliant. If it is possible to be in films without taking your clothes off or killing people with machine guns, I seem to have managed. Dame Maggie Smith, who's died at the age of 89.
Right, yes. From a stage and screen legend to a music one. Now that's a tune. The selector on my radio, delighted to say, Pauline Black from the band is here with us now to talk about a new film called Pauline Black, A Two-Tone Story. Hello, Pauline.
Hi there. Good evening.
Welcome aboard. We've spoken to you before and we always play the same record, so I'm conscious of that. We've got more, but it's a classic tune. It's brilliant. And we've got more selector music that we're going to just tickle in during the interview. So we'll play a selection. Anyway, welcome to Drive, Pauline. Great to speak to you. Can we talk about this film? What's your aim?
I think the aim is to tell the story from a female's point of view. Plenty of the guys have told their stories about being in the two-tone movement and being on the two-tone tour, all of those things. And I think I'm the first woman to do that. So I wanted to use a female director and also female producers. So it's an all-woman kind of production because I thought that we'd get the best out of it. And it was just such an exciting journey. I mean, the director, Jane Mingay, who I co-wrote the story with for the movie, is quite exceptional, and she's got sort of music background as well. So she knew what I was talking about, and that always helps.
If people love two-tone, and, you know, we're talking about bands selected, we've mentioned Specials, Madness, Bad Manners, The Beat, etc. You could go on and on. They'll love the genre. But what's really interesting about this movie, Pauline, is you look at your experiences personally, particularly, can we start with talking about your complicated family relationships. I've seen you talk about this film, and you may indeed say this in the film because I've not been fortunate enough to see it yet, but you say, more than anything, I wanted my family to finally say my name, Pauline Black. They could never bring themselves to say the B word. Talk to us about that relationship with your family.
Well, I was born in 1953, and I was adopted when I was 4 weeks old by a white working class family who lived in Romford in Essex. And they held the kind of views that many people up and down this country then chose to have regarding immigration and black people coming into this country. And there I was mixed race. My father was Nigerian and my mother was Jewish English. And so I grew up in a strange kind of a way. I mean, they basically brought me up like a little white girl, and I was always kind of railing against that, because when anyone else looked at me, what they saw was a black face. And I got very tired of being called coloured. So, of course, by the time I was 15 and the huge explosion that happened with The Black is Beautiful and James Brown named a nation and called it black, I was very eager to sort of claim that word as my own. But I had to wait until I joined the selector and I changed my name and I chose the surname Black, and ostensibly so that all my family would have to call me black, which they hated that word. They liked the word coloured.
How on earth did you navigate all that? As you said, mixed race in a family that couldn't do that. How did your relationships with your family develop over the years?
Well, it was quite interesting. I mean, what you've got to remember is that if you're living on the outside of something and viewing something which is relatively distasteful, or distasteful certainly if you're a person of colour, it's a little bit like being, an eavesdropper. An eavesdropper on some of the worst excesses of, what might be called kind of casual racism in this country. And this was the 50s. So people have been through two world wars and all those kinds of things. So, I mean, I fully understood, maybe not at that time, but I do now, I fully understood that people were very precious about what Britain meant to them and all that. But nonetheless, immigration had happened. The Windrush generation had come in. And people were coming here as students, which my Nigerian father did, to study. So there were black people within London, but there weren't really many in places where I grew up back then anyway.
Well,
like
no,
Longford.
And similar for me in industrial Lancashire as well. And it took bands like yours and the Specials that we regularly saw on Top of the Pops to see that these different cultures that we were not experiencing. And the beauty of Two Tone for me was it showed black and white mixing happily and gave a great message. However, Pauline, and we could talk for hours, but we've only got a few minutes left. So I want to just address something else that follows on from exactly what you've just said, because even when Two Tone first began and you the bands like yours toured and the Specials, and I went to some of these concerts, they attracted, if you will, the wrong kind of audience in some aspects, that, you know, a far-right skinhead kind of racist crowd, really. And that must have been slightly strange for you to see those people.
It was slightly strange. I mean, we play places like the Hammersmith Palais, and there will be a small contingent, and I do mean a small contingent of people like that. We didn't attract those people, but they were looking for trouble. You know, the rest of the 1,800 people, say, that were there were very much into the music and very much on board with the message that we had. So we go into that in the film. But it's not just about Two Tone. I mean, when I say a Two Tone story, I am Two Tone personified. I am mixed race. I am half black. I am half white. And I've lived with that throughout my life. Fortunately, there's a lot more people like that around now, because, I mean, miscegenation is probably the way out of things. But I think it's very timely, the way that this film has actually dropped at this moment.
Yeah.
Because what happened in the summer, we can see that those people are still out there. They still hold those views. They're still underground views. And it is strange for me at the age that I am now that I'm still fighting the same thing as I did when I was young.
And that's what makes the film absolutely fascinating. It's getting great reviews, Pauline. We've got to end it there, but really good luck with it.
Oh, thank you. And thank you so much for having me on the programme as well. I hope people will come see it. Thank you.
It's called Pauline Black, A Two-Tone Story. Look out for it. Look it up on the internet. You'll find out where it's showing. Go and support it. Great. 5 to 7.
Yeah, 5 minutes left until 7 o'clock. Just enough time to get to Elliot Lords for the final time today. And Ellie, there's been a wicket.
Yes, Travis Head, really belligerent 34 from him, but he's just been bowled by Brighton Cast. Australia, though, made a good start. 69 for one after 9 overs. Target is 313. So they've got just under 30 overs left in which to get those remaining runs. But Marsh, 26, still there. And Smith is the new batter, yet to get off the mark. 69 for one, Australia.
Ellie Aldred for the final time in the show tonight. Thank you.
BBC Radio 5 Live. The voice of the UK. On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker
to play BBC Radio 5 Live.
5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Okay, you might have heard this today. The All England Club in Wimbledon, plans for a huge expansion have been approved. They are being allowed to build 39 new tennis courts and an 8,000-seater stadium on a former golf course just across the road from where the main complex is. Now, the Deputy London Mayor, Jules Pipe, said the significant community and economic benefits outweigh the harm to protected land. So let's hear from Putney MP Fleur Anderson, who is opposed to those plans.
I'm extremely disappointed. It's been several years of campaigning by thousands and thousands of local people from a very wide area against this very damaging development on our lovely park. And I'm very disappointed that it will now be going ahead.
Well, we can speak to the spokeswoman for the campaign group Save Wimbledon Park, Susan Cusack. Hi, Susan. Disappointed?
Obviously, yes, very disappointed. We would have hoped that our very, very strong objections were going to actually be listened to today and deeply analysed, but unfortunately that didn't happen. And yes, the green light was given for the planning application.
Is that it then? Is there anything else you can do?
That's certainly not it. A letter has come through from Merton Council this afternoon confirming that the covenants will still be respected, and those covenants would prevent any building on the land, because the land was bought in 1993 by the All England Club from Merton Council, but with it were three very strict covenants, and one of them said that no building could take place. So at the moment, until the covenants would be, you know, would be satisfied, the building cannot, you know, could not take place.
Susan, just for those who aren't aware, because some people might think that, you know, the expansion of Wimbledon is a good thing, what are your concerns around this?
Well, our concerns are this is metropolitan open land. It's urban green belt. It has the same status as green belt. It's a heritage park. It's an ancient, it's a really ancient parkland that has never, ever been built on. The difference between a not so private golf club, where there is no cement or concrete in the ground, and an industrial tennis complex where the 39th court is going to be a stadium, which is 28 metres high, 104 metres wide, on metropolitan open land. The other 38 courts are obviously, they are grass courts, but that means that only 5% is organic material. The other 95% is concrete surrounds, which take 105 tonnes of concrete for each court, totaling 4,000 tonnes of concrete. That concrete surround is filled up with gravel, smaller bits of gravel. It's all crushed down. Then there's loam, soil, and just 8 millimetres of heavily pesticized grass on top.
Okay.
So when you look at this green, you know, area, it's not really green. There's very little green underneath it.
Susan, I hate to interrupt you, but time is ticking, I'm afraid. And
okay.
Would you do me a favour and keep us posted then if you do go ahead with this judicial review application, okay?
Well, we haven't decided on any judicial review or anything because obviously the covenants have to take their place. So
Susan, we will have to leave it there. We're just getting to 7 o'clock. That is Susan Cusack from Save Wimbledon Park. Thank you for your time on that.
Yeah, that story will run and run. Steve Smith is out in the cricket. Really important wicket for England. 75 for 2 now, Australia chasing 315. He's out for 5, so that's pretty good. Thank you very much for everyone who's been with us today.
Didn't know you had it in you.
That's all from James, who's probably having a lie down right now.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 7 o'clock. This is Nikki Cardwell. The King has paid tribute to the actor Dame Maggie Smith, who's died at the age of 89. She said the curtain had come down on a national treasure whose warmth and wit shone through on and off the stage. The actor Hugh Bonneville praised her sharp wit and formidable talent. Alex Jennings starred with her in the film The Lady in the Van and says she was a pleasure to work with.
It was a really tough shoot for her. She was very uncomfortable, stuck in the back of a Bedford van in Alan Bennett's driveway. And she was kind of fearless and incredibly well prepared always. She was heartbreaking and very funny.
The Israeli military says it's carried out what it called a precise strike on Hezbollah's central command headquarters in the southern suburbs of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Huge plumes of smoke could be seen rising from the densely populated area as a number of powerful explosions were heard. The Israeli military spokesman, Daniel Hagari, gave more details.
Hezbollah's central headquarters was intentionally built under residential buildings in the heart of the Dahiya in Beirut, as part of Hezbollah's strategy of using Lebanese people as human shields.
Two boys have become Britain's youngest ever knife killers after receiving life sentences and will serve a minimum of 8.5 years for the murder of a teenager in Wolverhampton. They were 12 when they killed 19-year-old Sean Cissahe with a machete last November. The crime and justice commentator Danny Shaw says it shows how easily knives can be obtained.
Very sadly, a very serious crime, which tells us something, I think, about the propensity of some young people to use violence and to pick up weapons like this machete, which one of these young boys had bought for £40 and kept under his bed.
Climate activists from Just Stop Oil have poured soup over two Van Gogh paintings at the National Gallery in London, just hours after two members were jailed for a similar attack. Phoebe Plummer, who's 23, was sentenced to 2 years in prison. 22-year-old Anna Holland was given 20 months for targeting the artist's sunflowers in 2022. The National Gallery said three people had been arrested after the latest attack and the paintings had not been damaged.